And a quick reminder that 1 week from Friday here in Studio S at WKAR, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer will be here. That is Friday the 11th. Everybody's focused on the holiday, but we're looking a little beyond the holiday. We'll take a quick minute to remind you of that. He will be responding and available to respond to your phone calls and questions. And the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capital Bureau Chief Rick Pluta will be in this chair talking with Mr. Schauer. June has come and just about gone. The governor signed budgets this month, though not for a comprehensive road funding package, as many had hoped. Primary candidates traded jabs, and the Detroit Free Press shined an intense light on the state's charter schools. That has generated a lot of discussion. As we do every month, we welcome a roundtable of state capitol reporters to review the month's biggest developments. Tim Skubick wears many hats. One of them is host of Michigan Public TV's Off the Record on WKAR. Tim, good to see you.
Uncle Mark, good to see you.
Journalist Emily Lawler is a correspondent with MERS News based in Lansing. Hi, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
And John Lindstrom is the longtime publisher of Gongwer News in Lansing. John, welcome back.
Thank you.
A comprehensive series of reports by the Free Press has generated a lot of attention. The paper explored oversight and operation of Michigan's nearly 400 charter schools, found instances of low or no transparency, poor academics, suspicious financial transactions. At the same time, it did acknowledge a number of Michigan charter schools are well-run, effective, and innovative. What impact have these stories had, Tim?
Well, it was a slow news week, so this helped immensely, don't you think? There was nothing else going on.
It was substantial. I mean, this generated a lot of attention.
Rarely in the biz do you see any news organization commit 2 years to review something. So that on its own deserves some sort of applause. Obviously, the charter school people were not applauding. They did not like it. They accused the primary writer of the column of leaving a lot of stuff out and having an agenda. Dan Quisenberry stopped just short of saying it was a political agenda, and he was scratching his head as to why some of the information he provided did not get into the extensive coverage. And, of course, the Free Press editorial people defended what was in there. As Bill Ballinger pointed out on our show last week, I don't think it broke any new ground per se, but for the first time since charters have been around since the beginning of John Engler, former governor, you saw a comprehensive review of what's been going on, and it's a mixed bag.
No, I don't think it broke new ground for us as reporters, but for the general public, especially if you don't have school-age children, aren't considering charter schools as an option, I think that the fact that they're spending $1 billion of public money every year with little to no, arguably less oversight than public schools, is new on some people's radars.
The scale of the story was certainly impressive, and of course it was an opportunity for Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer to sound off on Governor Snyder and Republicans in an election year. Here's one clip. This comes from the Michigan Public Radio Network's Jake Neer.
We need to write into law the oversight that was left out when Rick Snyder lifted the cap on the number of charter schools. It's the Wild West right now, and these schools see kids with dollar signs on their foreheads.
John Lindstrom, does that capture the way a lot of people feel about charter schools in Michigan?
It does, because in many respects, at least from my standpoint, what was more interesting than the series itself was the reaction to it, which reflects in many respects the overall poisonous atmosphere that people have had for the last 20 years in trying to talk about education.
This is Venus and Mars stuff politically.
It is virtually impossible to have an honest, dispassionate discussion about what do we need to do to fix schools in this state these days, because whoever gets into the conversation generally comes from one of two viewpoints. One is that public schools have completely failed and we should get rid of them, or the corollary of that is that the teachers' unions are destroying the schools. And the other is, well, everything would be fine if we didn't have charter schools and this backdoor way of trying to finance private parochial schools that you hear a lot of charter school opponents say. And there are a number of issues that we need to look at in terms of improving education in the state, and I'm not sure how we can do that unless people can find some way of disenthralling themselves and looking at it honestly. I mean, A Nation at Risk came out 32 years ago. And what's changed? And in many respects, not a lot, not a lot.
Is there more of a middle ground here than we might think, Emily, or is it as polarized as John suggests?
I think if there is a middle ground, it's high-performing charter schools. Right now, the people who are against charter schools say, look, they're not doing any better than the public schools they're supplanting. And, of course, the advocates of charter schools are saying, look, they're doing great. You know, I think if the charter school people stepped back and said, yeah, like everyone else, we have good schools and bad schools. Here's what's going right and how you can emulate it and create your own model to replicate that. I think that's what could be successful.
I think what a lot of people are bothered by is this concept of for-profit charter schools that we're paying. And if the data is correct, 60% of Michigan's charter schools are run by for-profit companies who basically come in and try to make money off of school kids. Now, that sort of sounds, well, if you're a free market person, it's fine. Remember, charter schools were brought in to be competitive with the public schools to raise the boat for everybody. I'm not sure that occurred. But the for-profit thing is an interesting thing, and there's a back and forth as to whether they are disclosing where this $1 billion is going. Now, Mr. Quisenberry said, yeah, they're disclosing where it's going on, but they are private businesses. But the Free Press pointed out that some of the private businesses didn't disclose everything. And so you have this constant back and forth. The governor checked in basically saying that he was open to looking at both school systems, was very careful not to say he was picking on charter schools, but if we're going to look at transparency and accountability, we ought to look at the public and the private schools and the charter schools together, and if there's any reform needed, the governor would look at it, but he stopped short of calling for specific changes in the law.
Tim, you landed Dan Quisenberry of MAPSA, the Michigan Association of
Public
Schools.
That was not really a landing. I think they wanted some exposure. that was not a get, Mark.
As long as we're referring to the back and forth, let's listen to a little bit of it from off the record here. This is an interesting exchange because one of your panelists, Kathy Gray, writes for the Free Press. This is Kathleen asking Dan Quisenberry about this documentation.
How do you explain for-profit companies telling their board members, telling the media, we don't have to give you that information, we're a private company?
Well, what information are they talking about? Leases, contracts, budgets, things that are expended at that school are absolutely provided and required, and authorizers go through it and look at it as well.
But they weren't.
Well, that's where... give me a specific circumstance,
I can
tell you.
At some schools, but at others?
Oh, no.
Is that the whole point?
Well, if the case is human, are human beings and their function perfect? Never, right? That's what regulation and enforcement of accountability is all about.
I was struck by the emphasis on those words. Regulation and enforcement he seemed to suggest that they're two different things. Reading between the lines, the regulation exists, the enforcement isn't there. Any thoughts on that?
Well, one of the ironies in this state is that really the Department of Education has almost zero authority to shut down a school. Doesn't matter what it is, public school or charter school. And that's a question that I think people need to seriously think about. I mean, if the goal is to get kids into better performing schools, and if the only way you can really do that, as some people might say, is provide the threat of shutting down a school, And there are all of these different formulas and theory to do it, but the state agency can't do that. Is that something that people should look at?
Mr. Quisenberry suggested that there be a 5-year window for getting this right, and if you're not, the schools will be closed down. And he said, if I read his document correctly, that they would be agreeable to that. But the people that accreditate these charter schools, the universities, MSU not included, Wayne State does, U of M does not, these folks are supposed to go in, and they are supposed to be the watchdogs. And one of the allegations in the Free Press piece was basically they sort of, well, we don't want to shut these guys down willy-nilly. There are neighborhoods to be concerned with. There are kids that would be out on the street. But if the watchdog function is to work properly, that's probably where it is right now. It's certainly not with the media, and it's not with the legislature, and as John correctly points out, it's not with the Board of Education. So we probably need to beef that up a little bit. Mr. Quisenberry said there were 360 charter schools. Today, 60 of them have been closed. That's about 17%.
And has the Free Press succeeded in making this a bigger election issue between now and November than it was before?
I don't know know about an election issue just because it's already pretty much most Democrats are opposing, you know, charter school expansion while most Republicans are supporting it. So I'm not sure if it's going to really play in.
Emily Lawler of MERS, John Lindstrom of Gongwer News, Tim Skubick of WKAR-TV's Off the Record, our panelists today on WKAR's Month in Review. Switching gears, it was notably the month that ongoing efforts to fund roads and infrastructure collapsed. It was kind of 2007 all over again there at the state capitol.
2006, 2005, 2004, 2003.
A number of 2000s. Democratic Senate leader Gretchen Whitmer said Republicans chose to just throw in the towel and walk away. She blasted the governor for a lack of leadership. How was it the two parties couldn't find enough common ground to get a big deal done?
Well, the common ground that was proposed, the first thing that went up on the Senate floor was raising the wholesale tax on gasoline substantially. When the Republicans couldn't get behind that, the next deal wasn't really a boost for roads or not as big of one. It would have just kept the tax at basically the same rate but moved it to the wholesale level.
Tim, your thoughts?
This is more of the same. I mean, you know, it takes 20 votes to do something, and Richardville, I think, made a gallant shot at it. Ms. Whitmer, I think probably she said she had squeezed her caucus about as much as she could. I was told there probably was another vote there. One of the key votes was Mo Hood, Jr. They came close to getting him, but they didn't. So now, I love this, they're forming a summer work group. I ran into Richardville the other day. He said he will likely announce this week who are the lucky people to sit on that, is if we need another study on the road issue. I mean, really. But we'll have a work group over the summer. And the interesting thing is, the lawmakers that are back home on the campaign trail, what kind of flack, if any, are they going to get when they walk in the 4th of July parade? Will they get cheers or boos from the people along the sidelines? And I don't know.
Well, why didn't it go? Because it has to do with taxes. That's why it didn't go. And it's never easy under any circumstances to raise taxes. And there was enough of a vigorous fight from opponents saying, look, the money that we need is there. You just have to find it and use it and, I don't know, cut spending other places and things like that. And Tim is right. I mean, I'm not sure what the reaction is going to be to people. I mean, there's an awful lot of people, they just don't want to pay any more taxes, and that's understandable.
Mm-hmm. This was vintage Michigan. We want Cadillac roads at Volkswagen prices.
It's exactly, this is the same fight that this state has had forever. I mean, we have never funded roads at a level that most other states do. And we provide for certain provisions, for example, in the trucking industry, that other states don't. And how do we resolve that? I don't know.
I was struck by it appeared that an awful lot of people learned that quite a bit of the tax paid at the pump here in our state is sales tax and therefore does not get earmarked to road funding. It goes to municipalities, it goes to education.
They couldn't even do that. They couldn't even earmark the sales tax for roads because that perturbs the schools and the municipalities. Some people said this was a time to lock everybody in the room, send in no food, yeah, turn off the air conditioner, and don't let them out until they do something.
You wrote a column that appeared on MLive, Tim, that exposed some interesting crosswinds to this debate. Some suggested the victory of Virginia Tea Party Republican Dave Bratt actually weakened Republican support. Did you pick up on that at the Capitol?
Well, people were Jack Brandenburg, who was a firm no vote on this, said, you know what, there were guys in the caucus that took a second look at that. I think the die was already cast. I think this just added more poison to the well.
There's also the thinking that Democrats gain political leverage in an important election year if road funding fails. Did any of you see any evidence of that?
I mean, obviously, if you can deny, if you're a Democrat and you can deny the governor a victory, who's going to walk away from that if you're a Democrat? But Tim is absolutely right. I think in the end they just wouldn't get to it. I think the situation in Virginia just, you know, put the final hammer stroke to the nail, and we are where we are, and how we're going to get out of it, I don't know.
We seem to be reading more about the trucking industry, I think, in the aftermath of the failure of this thing. Some are saying the trucking industry is getting too much of a pass. Do you expect the trucking industry will pick up more of the tab in any future solution to this?
It'd be hard to get through. It's part of the Democrats' argument that they've been saying for 3 to 4 years under Governor Snyder here is basically that a lot of the tax burden has been shifted from corporations to people. So their argument is that the trucks should have to pay more than you and I driving down the road getting to work.
And right. And the trucks are willing to pay higher fines. In fact, that was up there, and right. But they couldn't get the votes for that. I mean, if you can't raise the fines on trucks, how are you going to raise taxes on common folk to pay for the roads?
Well, and I think it's interesting that they were willing to pay fines. What they were not willing to pay was a tax rate that is equal to what the tax is on gasoline. If you simply raise the diesel tax right. to the same tax rate, I'm not saying that take care of everything, but you'd still raise a significant chunk of change.
Well, it eliminates the impression that the truckers are getting a free ride. Okay,
yes,
we're not
absolutely.
Paying their fair share,
mm-hmm.
Which is something to be politically exploited. But the truck thing is not the central part of the problem. Okay, it's just the political will to do what's a tough thing to do, and so far they haven't done it.
More incrementalism, then, is what appears to be in the future?
Well, the House package was passed. It was $450 million. The Senate didn't even do that. I was surprised they left town with that unresolved.
Yeah, this is really kind of astonishing. We talked about this a few weeks ago that you know, when the year started, we had this big surplus and everyone was saying, "Oh, we're going to give everyone a tax break." And as you know, the winter destroyed what was left of the roads. All of a sudden, we go, "No, we're going to fix the roads. We're going to put all this money in towards the roads." And here it is, as you say, the end of June, and what? You know, there's no additional money put forth. And people are we helped a fellow who's moving here from California to get a doctorate here at MSU, and we were showing him around town. He said, "Man, the roads are really bad, aren't they?"
Welcome to Michigan. That is pure Michigan.
Pure Michigan.
That's right. Welcome to Michigan. You know, so.
I don't even want to think how this process is supposed to restart. Have any of you thought ahead of that?
Look, they'll come back in lame duck after everybody's safely reelected, and they will do something.
That would be the best chance.
10 days ago, Governor Snyder signed legislation approving the state's role in the Detroit Grand Bargain. That approved $194 million, rainy day fund dollars for Detroit, that would minimize pension cuts for retirees and future legal costs for the state. Was this as big a deal as it appeared, Emily?
Definitely. It was definitely a big deal and a big moment of bipartisanship, which I think was subsequently undone by a lack of action on roads. But it's definitely, if approved, the campaign now is that the Detroit retirees and a couple of unions have to kind of sign on to this plan, which, you know, the state's argument is, we're putting in money, we're trying to help shore this up so that you avoid what could come out of a potentially worse situation in bankruptcy court.
Talk about the buzz Detroit generated at Mackinac Island. We're going back actually to May here now instead of June. But, Tim, I mean, we're all led to believe Detroit was one of the key topics, not the top.
If I may, let me take you back to January when the governor proposed this. I think the popular wisdom in town was this had two chances, slim and none, that this would just be too much of a heavy lift. So I think strong leadership on the governor's part, strong leadership on the Democrats who saddled up with the Republicans to do this, to rise above the traditional anti-Detroit mantra, which is apparent every election year. Think of the years that all the guys in the House ran against Coleman Young, the mayor of Detroit. They ran ads with his picture in order to get reelected. They somehow miraculously set that aside and said, "We've got to do something for Detroit." On the island, it was the major issue of discussion. Mr. Orr gave a rather passionate speech to all the assembled folks there, and they got it done. And I think they deserve high marks for doing that because it was a heavy, heavy lift.
And we await the vote of pensioners in Detroit here now.
That's obviously a major thing. We also wait to see what the court's going to do with the bondholders who are still suing. But I think one of the points that Tim is raising is I think people were very surprised at how much support the city had throughout the state. I mean, I was one of the days on there, somebody just came up to me up on the island and they said, "You know, whatever you can do to fix Detroit, please do it." And I said, "Well, it's not really my call, but I'll pass that along. I'll pass it along to the proper people." But it's fascinating. You know, there's been a lot of polling that shows that the city has more support than people might think.
Have we begun to repair this dichotomy between, yeah, Detroit matters and to heck with Detroit?
Maybe. It's hard to say, but maybe.
Mike Duggan deserves also part of this credit. I mean, he has now been in town 5 more times than Dave Bing even thought about coming to town. And he worked it well. I remember I bumped him and I said, how's it going? He says, I'm amazed that I'm not getting a lot of flack. And I said, what rooms are you working, Mr. Mayor? But he said, I went into the House Republican caucus and they gave him, applause. This, as I said, was a tough vote. They put the anti-Detroit stuff aside and it was the way the process is supposed to work.
Duggan and Detroit appear to be having a honeymoon here. Is that an overstatement?
No, not at all. And there's still, enormous issues, obviously, in the city. One of the big things that's still going to have to happen is you still have to find a way of reducing crime further, obviously. Schools still need to be fixed up. And you need to get some way of getting some more investment into the city. In terms of industrial development, commercial development, something where you can actually have people working in the city. Mm-hmm. But there's some very, very hopeful, certainly more hopeful signs that I've seen in decades now that maybe something's going to happen.
Tim Skubick, Emily Lawler, John Lindstrom are our guests on WKAR Current States Month in Review. Let's talk congressional primary races. First and foremost, in our 8th district, there are a few debates and appearances that are under the candidates' belts now. Give us your take on McMillan and Bishop in the GOP contest. Where does this stand?
Bishop's to lose.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah. Honestly, truly.
You would disagree?
Yeah,
You think it's McMillan's to lose?
No. I'm sorry. I thought you said that Bishop was going to lose.
It's his to lose.
It's Bishop's.
Yes. No, I would agree with that statement. I think that Tom McMillan is a little bit too conservative for the Oakland County part of the district, which is where he's from. And it's interesting, too, that Bishop and McMillan are pretty much neighbors. They're both from this Oakland County portion, and there are other two other counties to consider here.
John?
I think one of the more interesting things about it is some of the stuff we've seen on the internet each side using the other candidate to either say, oh, Tom McMillan supports Mike Bishop, or Jennifer Granholm supports Mike Bishop, or however you want to spin it. I think that Mike Bishop clearly has the advantage in that he has gotten the support of Mr. Rogers and basically the party establishment is sort of quietly supporting him. But I've been surprised in talking to people and listening to people low-key that Tom McMillan has more support than you might think. Part of it is there are some people that just feel maybe it's time to get a libertarian in there. Part of it is some people have some personal problems with Mr. Bishop, so
well,
I don't know.
He's run a number of times down there and lost. He wanted to be prosecutor.
He tried to get the nomination in 2010 to be Attorney General. He worked the Tea Party element very hard to get that. That didn't happen. So we'll see. I think in the end he will be the nominee, but it could be a little more interesting.
There's a lot of noise from around the country too. I mean, there's other things in play here. Certainly the Virginia situation, everybody keeps an eye on that and factors that into this thing. The two websites that have been generated from this thing are interesting to say the least. GranholmForBishop.com. Is one of them, and on the other side, McMillanForBishop.com are two websites that MERS News explained has just appeared recently in this whole thing. What about elsewhere? What about any other districts? What jumps to the top here for any of you?
I mean, I think the 11th is another one where we're watching kind of a Tea Party versus more Republican establishment situation develop. Kerry Benvolio is the current office holder there. He kind of got in on this strange occurrence. And then they have David Trott, who seems to be backed by more of the establishment Republicans.
The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta told our listeners last week that there are, back to the 8th here now, that there are few serious policy differences between Mike Bishop and Tom McMillan. You're nodding your head yes Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to come down to, you know, minor differences and experience. Bishop has obviously some leadership experience that McMillan doesn't, but that said, McMillan is currently a sitting legislature.
The Amash race over on the west side of the state is interesting. The establishment Republicans are against Mr. Amash. The DeVos people are with him. Game over.
The polling in that race, the Amash Ellis race, has been surprising. The Chamber of Commerce people and those folks who support Brian Ellis have been dumping all kinds of money in it, and yet so far the polling shows Justin Amash way ahead of Brian Ellis.
Very interesting. Give us an idea what you're all working on here this week.
Cleaning out the cottage. No, we don't have a cottage, okay? Just getting through the week. We're doing a story today on what the heck are we doing today? The governor, is the governor vulnerable on the issue? Are you better off 4 years ago than you are today? Okay. And the D's will make something out of that, and he will try to defend the fact. Interesting point, he has a dashboard for everything, but he does not have a dashboard for his business tax on whether it's working or not. Mm. The D's say that might be on purpose. The governor says it would be too difficult to put together.
Emily? I'm going back and looking at actually some campaign promises that the governor had made or goals that he had outlined and trying to see if they match up with what's actually happened. So
well,
it sounds like Tim and I maybe could collaborate.
Similarly here. John?
Well, obviously, we're now heavily into the campaign season, and that's one thing that we're going to be following. Just for today, since today is the U.S. Supreme Court's final day and they'll be issuing the ruling on the Hobby Lobby situation, there were a number of Michigan companies that were also involved in that, so it'll be interesting to see whatever spinoff comes from that. So,
this is the time of the year where we earn our keep.
Yes, understood. Tim Skubick of Off the Record, Emily Lawler, MERS News, John Lindstrom, publisher of Gongwer News, based in Lansing. Many thanks to all of you.
Thanks,
Happy
Mark.
Fourth. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. As the importance of China's influence grows, so does the need for people who understand Chinese culture and the Chinese language. To foster that sort of understanding, universities across the United States, including Michigan State University, have established Confucius Institutes. Host universities like MSU work with the Chinese education agency Hanban to train teachers from the U.S. and China to promote Chinese language learning. Recently, though, the American Association of University Professors called on schools to either scrap their partnerships or renegotiate them. The AAUP says these arrangements lack transparency and put academic freedom at risk. Current state Scott Pohl has more on the AAUP's complaints about Confucius Institutes. Welcome back, Scott.
Hi, Mark. MSU started a Confucius Institute 8 years ago. We're going to talk with two representatives of MSU's Confucius Institute in a few minutes. But first, let's hear from York Teed. He's a professor at Illinois Wesleyan University and a member of the committee that approved the AAUP statement criticizing Confucius Institutes. He thinks the AAUP's position on them has been misunderstood.
I mean, I think what is important, because this has been somewhat misrepresented by the Chinese news media in particular, is that this is not specifically directed at China or Confucius Institutes. There are specific example that we picked because there were a number of reports in the press recently about concerns. But what we have to say is very general about the establishment of institutes like the Confucius Institutes at American universities under the conditions that Confucius Institutes are created. I think the main concern about them is that they are created in American universities as separate entities funded by a foreign government or by a foreign government-related entity. In particular, that the instructors teaching there are hired and trained by a foreign government entity, and that they supply teaching material like textbooks. That means that the kind of institutional autonomy and faculty role in selecting instructional staff and in selecting teaching material is now being handed over to an outside entity, and that concerns the AAUP.
What might be at risk?
I mean, what is at risk is the freedom of exchange that occurs in classrooms all over the United States. I think to pick a very specific example for a moment, suppose there's another Tiananmen Square massacre or something of that scale in China, and there are students in a class on Chinese culture that is organized by the Confucius Institute. Now, in other classes in the United States, it would be appropriate and completely accepted to have a discussion about ongoing issues in a country that is being studied. My understanding from what we read in the press is that Confucius Institute's instructors are trained specifically by Hanban to redirect conversations or questions that are raised in the classrooms about matters that the Chinese government does not wish to have discussed. That is not acceptable. That is not how academic freedom operates in the United States. It is not the purview of a foreign government to instruct professors how to deal with issues that it does not wish to see addressed in an American classroom.
Is it possible or likely, though, that some Confucius Institutes have addressed these matters in ways that might satisfy the AAUP, that some of these concerns don't exist in some institutions? For instance, at Michigan State University, MSU's contract with Hanban, they say that there are no non-disclosure clauses about financing in their agreements, that with regard to confidentiality, they have received no explicit or implicit messages about the confidentiality aspect of these agreements. Would you agree that some institutions have handled this in a way that might satisfy the AAUP?
Yes, that could very well be the case. And we have not individually studied each of these agreements. We're really mostly interested in having three specific concerns addressed that we enumerate in the statement that we released. We want to make sure that the university retains unilateral control over academic matters, that Confucius Institute teachers have the same academic freedom rights as faculty who are employed by the university, and that the agreements are made available to the university community. Any Confucius Institute or any collaboration with foreign governments that satisfies these kinds of constraints, we would not be concerned with. We are simply responding to reports in the press that there are instances at some universities in the United States where that is not the case.
York Teed is with the American Association of University Professors. Thank you for joining us on Current State.
You're welcome.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Well, we have heard the position of the American Association of University Professors. Let's turn to MSU's Confucius Institute for reaction. We're joined now by Associate Directors Nancy Romig and Ruwei Ni. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Nancy, what do you make of the AAUP's concerns about Confucius Institutes? They maintain at least some of them are threatened by a lack of transparency and a lack of academic freedom.
I think the issue that CIs are having is that it
is a blanket statement that seems to apply that these problems are associated at all Confucius Institutes, whereas a lot of institutes have already been basically adhering to what AAUP wants us to adhere to.
Rue Nia, tell us about your experience with the MSU Confucius Institute. You handle direct communications with the Chinese Education Agency, Hanban, because of the language, but you've also gone through the program and have taught in China.
Yes, that's true. At CIMSU, I handle the direct communication with Hanban, and also I've been invited as a trainer at Hanban's teacher training to prepare teachers before they send them to CIS across the world. So for two statements that we heard from AAUP, the first about disclosure, I can say on behalf of our CI is that our agreement with Hanban is always, we never have any undisclosure problem with that. It's always under review of the public. So, and there's no clause of undisclosure in our agreement.
Mm. You ever felt pressured to withhold information about the Confucius Institute?
No, never. Never. I never had that pressure that to hide or to hold anything to review about Confucius Institute.
Nancy, do you think the AAUP investigated the Confucius Institute in depth to reach the conclusions they did?
No, I don't. I think that there are some examples out in the press that highlight some problematic CIs, and that is what drove their report, not looking at is this a systemic problem across all CIs or is this an isolated issue within certain CIs across the nation.
Are you confident that the CIs and the university professors will be able to work this out in the future?
I definitely hope so. I think that AAUP needs to come and look at possibly randomly selecting certain CIs and coming and looking and, you know, seeing what happens within the practices of CIs. Each CI has their own direction and purpose. For example, our focus is on K-12 education. Mm-hmm. And therefore, curriculum that is taught in language classes in K-12 are driven by the state standards. And therefore, it's impossible for Hanban to say that these give us a curriculum and say you have to teach this because state standards dictate what is taught in K-12 schools.
But you are willing to acknowledge that the kinds of concerns that the AAUP has may exist in other Confucius Institutes?
It yes. May.
Okay.
It may.
And how much do you know about that?
I don't think I know much about it. What I know is that every CI comes with different focuses. Some CI do have the teachers from China who teach in universities. I think that's where we have the problems. But in our case, we focus on K-12, as Nancy said. So the curriculum, text, and teachers, we have the screening and everything on those. As Nancy said, curriculums are actually determined by school district, not by us, not by Hanban.
Let's talk a little bit more about your particular mm-hmm. role here. You've said that K-12 Chinese language learning is your focus. You train teachers. It's a combination of Americans for whom Chinese is a second language and Americans for whom Chinese is the native language. And you were involved in getting Lansing's Post Oak Elementary School its Chinese immersion program. Tell us about that.
Correct. Several years back, we started conversations with Lansing School District on creating a Chinese immersion program. There were many hurdles involved with that in terms of teacher certification, meeting Michigan Department of Education's criteria for classroom teaching in K-12 schools, developing curriculum that incorporated Chinese language, but also immersion is subject-based language. So how can they use the Chinese language to teach the mathematics, the science, or the social studies? And we work very closely with Post Oak to start building the program. It has now encompasses preschool, through seventh grade and is going into eighth grade next year. Mm.
Very interesting. Ru Wei Ni, were you involved in the Post Oak School establishment there?
Not in a very deep way, but in general, that's part of CI's work. So I'm always working with that, but I'm not the person directly take charge of that program.
Okay. How many teachers are in MSU's program at any one time, Nancy?
Well, we have a couple of different programs within that encompasses teachers. For our classroom teachers, these are actually F1 students who use curricular practical training to do their experience in classrooms teaching. With that, they come into the programs the same way any other F1 international student will in terms of applications and MSU student policies on reviewing application processes.
Your focus is on K-12 education now. Do you see an expanded focus in coming years for the MSU Confucius Institute, Ru Wei Ni? Could that expand?
Of course. That could be growing and expand to some other level and the big scale or larger scope is possible. But it depends on how we operate the institute and depends on the resources, how much we can get, and depends on our long-term plan. We actually used to have a program which targeting the college student is a learning student in a virtual environment online. But we discontinue that for many reasons. So we do not want to restrict our future development in any specific, but we focus on K-12. That is also inconsistent with our background at the College of Education here.
Very interesting. We want to thank our guests here from MSU's Confucius Institute Associate Directors, Nancy Romig and Ru Wei Ni. Thanks for joining us on Current State. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. If you live in Michigan, it seems like every summer is a good time to complain about the mosquitoes being really bad this year. But how bad are they really? Here to talk about this year's mosquito crop and some of the issues connected to mosquito-borne illness is Dr. Ned Walker. Ned's a professor in MSU's Department of Entomology and the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
That was a mouthful. How is this summer shaping up to be in terms of mosquito populations? Do you have a sense of that?
We do. I mean, the mosquito populations right now are about three times larger than an average year for certain reasons related to the way the winter left a lot of snow melt and formed spring woodland pools, which produced a crop of mosquitoes. And then we've had a floodplain mosquito problem. And finally, a summer floodwater mosquito problem, and they're all converged at the same time.
Oh, boy. Well, how much could that change, though, due to short-term fluctuations in the weather? If we went a week or 10 days without rain, would that drastically change the outlook for the rest of the summer?
It would, because our mosquito populations are mostly guided by the intensity and frequency of rainfall we have. Mm-hmm. And we've been having a series of storms come through our area, and that's the kind of thing that keeps our mosquito populations going.
We were up in Petoskey yesterday, and the locals were telling us about the 15 inches of rain they got just last October. This goes back a few months. But, I mean, this has been a pattern recently. It's been a great season for growing things because of the precipitation, but that brings on the mosquito concerns.
It does.
Yeah. What kinds of diseases can mosquitoes cause in humans in Michigan?
The primary one of concern is West Nile virus. And interestingly, this is a little bit counterintuitive, but in wet, cooler years, which we've had so far, West Nile virus risk is down. And the reason is that the mosquitoes that are out biting right now are not the ones that carry that virus. It's a different mosquito species that's associated with street catch basins, abandoned swimming pools, the more urban and suburban kinds of environments.
Is that the Anopheles?
It's called Culex.
Okay.
Yes, and it carries West Nile virus. And when we have lots of rain, for example, our storm systems get flushed out, and so the populations are actually reduced naturally. And so when we have lots of rainfall, the West Nile virus risk diminishes, and that's what I would predict so far for this year.
And West Nile is your uppermost concern? Is that your top concern? Or
it is. The other one, of course, is dog heartworm, which humans don't get, but mosquitoes carry that parasite, and dogs can become infected. The mosquitoes that are out right now biting are ones that can carry that parasite, which is in our coyote populations, for example. And so people that have dogs should consult mm-hmm. their veterinarians and get them on the medicine.
Mm-hmm. People may not realize there was a time when Michigan had a significant malaria problem. This goes back to the 19th century. But there are some predictions that if the climate gets warmer, that could be possible again. What do you think?
It's entirely possible. We do have our Anopheles mosquitoes, which carry malaria. They're still with us. A lot of that, I think, depends not only on just climate change, because the climate back then was appropriate for malaria, so it's still appropriate now, even more so probably, but also socioeconomic conditions, because malaria goes away when housing gets better and when you have hospital care and so on. And back then, that was not the case as it is now. So, you know, if we have changing socioeconomic conditions, that could happen. There are some other mosquito-borne diseases that are really right on the horizon. There's a new virus that's just emerged from Africa into Asia, now into Europe, and it's come to the Western Hemisphere within the past year, called chikungunya virus. And Michigan has just had its first two imported cases of that virus, but it's people who've traveled to the Caribbean and Haiti in particular on mission work and so on, and they've brought it back. And whenever you start to move viruses like this around through people's travel, it could introduce it.
Very interesting and very worrisome. Dr. Ned Walker is our guest. Ned is professor of in MSU's Department of Entomology and the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics. We're talking about mosquitoes and mosquito-borne illness here in Michigan in 2014. So how long does it take standing water to attract mosquitoes and have eggs laid in there? Is there a window of opportunity?
There is. What happens with the rainfall patterns is it'll rain and then those environments will dry up. And the mosquitoes somehow know how to lay their eggs in an area that will be flooded by inundation after a rainfall event. They lay their eggs in the leaf litter and in the soil. And I'm talking about floodwater mosquitoes now. We have other mosquito species that lay their eggs directly on top of standing water. But the mosquitoes that are out and biting us right now and that are pests are of the kind where they lay their eggs in soil and leaf litter, and rain or snowmelt comes along and floods those areas. The eggs hatch, the larvae live in the water. And right now, within probably at the current temperatures, within about a 10-day period, the adult mosquitoes will hatch out of those environments, and then we'll have them. They'll stay alive for probably 21 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it rains again, another egg hatch, and it can just snowball depending mm-hmm. upon the rainfall pattern.
What can homeowners and others do to slow this process down?
I get that question a lot from people because especially in June, you have backyard events like graduation parties, there may be weddings and things like that, and people also just want to enjoy their outdoors around their home. And a lot depends upon your personal sort of chemical policy, but there are sprays that you can buy and use. You can attach them, for example, to your garden hose and apply them as a wet spray in the perimeter vegetation. And that we call that a harborage treatment or a barrier treatment. And it temporarily knocks the mosquito population back for the few days that you need for your event. Of course, you can hire a private applicator, a company, to do the same thing.
You don't discourage that, then?
I don't discourage it. I think it can be a local way to alleviate mosquito populations and not really cause any kind of unwanted harm to the environment. Of course, there's the use of repellents, and some repellents work very well. I personally like these so-called dry formulations of Off, which don't feel so greasy. And then, of course, there's the standard repairing window screens and things like that, but it's hard to avoid mosquitoes when you're out on your back deck in the evening trying to grill, and here they come. So mm-hmm. people do ask this question a lot.
Yeah. Adults are kind of on their own on whether to use DEET, products containing DEET. DEET is a pretty strong chemical. What do you recommend for use on younger people, on kids?
Well, in children, there are formulations with DEET that are in the 7 to 8% range, and like Deep Woods Off has, I think, 40% DEET, but you can get down into a much lower concentration for children. And the advice there is to use the lower concentrations for children, and you can read that right on the label. It'll indicate the concentration. And secondly, parents and adults should not let children apply repellents onto themselves, but the adult or parent should do it instead to make sure that the can isn't mishandled and they don't spray into the eyes and so on.
Is there a positive, is there some kind of environmental benefit to mosquitoes? I mean, just about every animal has one or two good things about them. What good thing can you say about mosquitoes in Michigan?
Well, I think aesthetically they're quite interesting, I have to say. I mean, if you look at one under a microscope, you go, oh, that's a pretty insect. It really is. They have scales on them. And, you know, everything has its inherent value, I suppose.
Provide some value, some advantage we're not aware of?
Well, they're not really anything that any other animal requires in their diet, for example. So if we were to get rid of all of the mosquitoes, it doesn't mean that other animals are going to suffer accordingly. Mm. The main thing is that they are what they are. They blood feed and they carry disease agents. Mm.
Dr. Ned Walker is a professor in MSU's Department of Entomology and the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics. We're talking Michigan mosquitoes. Dr. Walker, thank you.
Thank you.
That is our program for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we talk with John Austin of the Michigan Economic Center about the MEC's new report, Michigan Dream at Risk. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth's the producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery as well. Also to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.